of Dr. Frank Conrad, on November 2nd, 1920, the first scheduled pre-advertised radio program in the United States went on the air. Station KDKA was broadcasting returns of the presidential race on the evening of Election Day. From a humble beginning in a Pittsburgh garage to the sumptuous studios of the national radio networks in New York, Chicago, and Hollywood, these years have come to be known as the golden era of radio.
Starring the black sheep of the family, Joe Benner, with Gene Austin and the music of Jimmy Greer.
When my baby smiles at me, what a familiar, tuneful radio signature. And need I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that this melody heralds the approach to the microphone of that lovable, high-hatted tragedian of song, Ted Lewis.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bill Stern bringing you the 381st edition of the Colgate Shave Cream Sports Newsreel, featuring strange and fantastic stories.
I invite you to another informal session in which there'll be songs by Frank.
Good evening, everyone. WTIC Radio presents the first program in a series that will explore this golden era. This is Dick Bertel, and with me is the co-host for this program, the man with 2,000 hours of old-time radio on tape. Here he is, live and unrehearsed, Mr. Ed Corcoran of South Windsor. Ed, it's good to have you at this microphone for this, the first in our long series, I hope. Ed, let's bring our audience up to date. How did this collection of yours begin? When did you start collecting radio?
I started, Dick, in 1959. That's when I could afford a tape recorder. And at that time, radio was in its ebb years, you might say.
You were still recording off the air then?
Yes, I recorded off TIC and off the CBS outlet in town, too. Mm-hmm. They were running the Gunsmoke series at that time.
Well, how does that collection build over the years? Because now it goes back to the early 30s.
Well, I found other people throughout the country who have similar interests. And what happened was that they went around to various studios, various personalities, and they found some of these old transcriptions. These are these 17-inch jobs, which were never released commercially. These were pretty much in the archives of radio. These we brought out, we copied them, and we circulated them around the country. And in time, I got most of these in my collection.
Well, I know when you started, there were about 40 collectors all told in the country. How many are there today?
I'd say there's 40 probably in Connecticut alone. I'd say it must be several thousand right now. It's getting bigger every day. There's more people getting into it.
I have a hunch, too, that as this program continues, there will be more and more collectors taping our shows.
Well, we certainly hope so. That's what we want to do, is get people interested in this.
We've got some great stars tonight. We've got Bing Crosby. We have the Boswell sisters, Bob Burns, W.C. Fields, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, Lionel and John Barrymore, Diana Barrymore, Rudy Valley, Harry Richmond, Eddie Cantor, Burns and Allen, Park Yakarkis, the Mad Russian. Those are the names that we're going to be contending with tonight. And opposite this microphone is our guest for the evening, Stanley Quinn, director of the Radio and Television Center at the University of Connecticut, who entered this magic field of radio back in 1936, where he specialized in comedy writing for some of the greatest network radio shows on the air. Stan, it's good to have you on our initial show.
Well, it's very good to be here. This is a great kind of innovation, I think.
You know, we were talking, we mentioned Frank Conrad's name and how it all started back in November of 1920. And we were talking about how quickly this business mushroomed. By 1925, people were listening to radio all over the country, weren't they?
Well, not all over the country, but in very great areas of the country there were already interconnections in 25, to the extent that radio could by 25-26 be offered as an advertising medium to compete with national magazines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now that was a development in 5 years, illustrating I think a tremendous interest, a tremendous hunger for this kind of communication.
By 1926, the first network, at least, had been formed, NBC.
Yes, and CBS, I forget which was first and which was second. They both, in 26, 27, were formed. RCA was formed. RCA was formed to pull together a lot of independent manufacturers of equipment, because the tremendous desire for receivers made this a very interesting business. And then the telephone company bought a station. I think that was...
Would that have been WEAF?
EAF, right, right. WEAF. And tied all of a sudden a couple of stations together. And that was a very great innovation. And it just went like mushrooms, they say.
Well, it's been a great business ever since.
And I believe by 28 or 29, it was about the fourth biggest industry in the United States.
That's amazing for such a short period of growth, really. Well, before we trace your career, let's listen to one of the shows that you worked for as a comedy writer. Ed, this is from the Rudy Valley Fleischmann Yeast Program, I guess, isn't it?
Yes, it goes back somewhere, I guess, pre-war. And it does feature the Barrymores. Is this the one we're going to do first?
John and Lionel Barrymore and, I guess, Diana.
Diana, that was John's daughter. Yes, that's right.
Let's recall those voices.
Meet in store for us tonight with three members of the theater's royal family in our midst. Diana, John, and Lionel Barrymore. Diana, it's nice to have you with us again.
Oh, it's nice to see you too, Rudy. Are you on Father's program every week?
Yes, you see, I... Father's program?
Yes, I think it's nice of Father to give a newcomer like you a chance.
Newcomer? Diana, I've been in radio since I got my first pair of long pants. This is the same Rudy Valley.
And those are the same pants.
I'll overlook that.
Oh, we were only teasing, Rudy. I know you gave Father his start in radio. Actually, John Barrymore owes you a lot.
Why should I be an exception? Right, Lionel?
Right, Rudy.
You know, Uncle Lionel, Daddy has never told me which one of you is really the younger.
The younger? My dear Jay. Lionel was a young man when I got me first tooth. Yes, and I was still a young man when you got rid of your last one. Why, you...
Please, Daddy, Uncle Lionel. Oh, what business are you in, Uncle Lionel? What do you do?
What do I do? What? I do the same things your father does.
Why, Lionel... Surely you've seen your Uncle Lionel in pictures. Don't you go to movies?
Oh, I only see a movie when Father is the star.
Oh, then you don't know about talkies.
Well, anyhow, I'm proud of my father. And I'd like to know how I can best follow in his footsteps.
Well, do what the sheriff does. Get a bloodhound. Now look here, Brother Scrooge.
At ease, gentlemen. No fighting. I've invited you all here to act in a play that I've written.
Oh, say, I think it would be fun for all of us to act in a play together, especially the one that Rudy wrote. I bet it's wonderful.
Oh, it's nothing that Shakespeare couldn't do as well. If he were alive.
He could probably do as well the way he is.
No doubt, Rudy, you've cast a great profile in the leading role.
Well,
if you have, you can count me out of your
clan. Well, really,
of course, if the woman's role isn't the most important, I wouldn't consider it.
Well, heaven help a valley on a night like this.
Stop! The three Barrymores on Broadway. I can see our name in lights outside the theater. John Barrymore and Company.
And Company? Me play a supporting role?
Now, Lionel, you know I'm a star of this family. You've always supported me on the stage.
On the stage, he says.
After all, what difference does it make whose name comes first? Let's feature both Barrymore brothers and star Diana Barrymore.
The girl's a chip off the old block.
You mean a slice off the old ham.
Now, Stan, that was a typical routine, wasn't it?
It was exactly. Yes, indeed. It sounds very unfriendly, of course, but this was a staple of radio comedy spots, the insulting spot, and you can almost see how this spot was formed, the idea of what we would do, how we would make use of the personalities as the public knew them, of the Barrymores, exploit that image in this comic vein. And of course, each person has his own character, as Valley, as all of the radio people had to have their own unique little identification. Some of them did it with a particular phrase. Some of them did it with a careful building, like Benny, of a definite personality. They all made definite personalities.
Well, I see here on the list, Ed, that you featured Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy next, and that has to tie in with Stan's career, does it?
Yes, that's true. In fact, we were talking about that before we went on the air, and I guess you just missed W.C. Fields, wasn't it? Just a few weeks in your career there?
Yes, but let me tie in these two programs, the Rudy Valley Fleischman's Yeast Hour and the Edgar Bergen Jason Sanborn Hour. They were both shows produced by the radio department of the J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency. And the Rudy Valley Hour was, in truth, a landmark show in that you'd had in radio very big shows, but they were all music shows, popular band leaders and good bands, and popular singers. And this was the first show that incorporated comedy spots and personality interviews of a non-musical nature that made the form called Variety Show, which was a very, very popular form of radio entertainment. It was not a vaudeville show. A variety show had its own character, and that character made very many very big shows during the 30s.
As a matter of fact, the Variety Show was created in the J. Walter Thompson Advertising
Agency. That's right. A fellow named John U. Reber, who was the head of the agency, was the man who saw that radio could be a communication of man to man, of a kind of public resource of companionship. And it was this intuition that led him to put personality into this music show. But I want to tell you how we get to the Jason Sanborn Show. Now, the Jason Sanborn Show had been the flagship for Standard Brand since the early 30s, with big people. Eddie Cantor was one of the stars who headlined on the Jason Sanborn Show on Sunday night. That was the big hour. This was the big flagship show, and you had to have a big name. And radio had bigger names than television right through its career. It had the top names. So Cantor, I believe it was, who had been the MC, had to leave for some motion picture commitments or whatever. And here was this big hour, and it didn't have a big star to carry it. Well, coincidentally, on the Valley Show with its various acts, they always sought novelty in the acts. I must tell you that my first spot on the that I wrote on the Valley Show was with the rugby captain of Oxford. Mm-hmm. I mean, they went for this kind of oddball stuff, you know, because they had a good, solid show with music and everything. So one oddball idea was have a ventriloquist on radio. Huh? I tell you, this was the only show that could do it with this kind of casting. So they had Bergen on with McCarthy as a novelty. And he was a blockbuster.
Yeah, he sure was.
And so a fella who was writing the show, the Valley Show, says, oh, my God, we got to get this fella back. And he said to Bergen, that was just wonderful, Ed. We're going to have you again next week. And Bergen says, no, you're not. He says, what do you mean? You were great. Bergen said, look, I've been in the business 15 years. I have worked out in those 15 years two solid acts. I did one of them tonight.
And I'm not going to do the next one
to get out of the business, right? It took 3 or 4 days for Faulkner, the writer, to convince him that you could write spots for Charlie in radio, which, of course, they have done and did do very successfully.
This is one of the classics, I think. I wonder if you'd set the stage for us, Ed.
Well, of course, this is the Edgar Bergen, Charlie McCarthy, W.C. Fields. They had a real feud going, and this is more of the same. You know, the Barrymores started this in the earlier excerpt, and now we're going to hear a real blockbuster in terms of character assassination, if you will.
Charlie,
where is the little fire hazard?
Yes. I think I'll call him in, Bill, in just a moment. Oh, Charlie!
He's not here.
Never mind.
Charlie!
I want you to know that Bill is right here.
Yes.
Yes. And he knows all about it.
Uh-huh.
And Charlie wants to talk to you.
Yeah?
Yeah.
No.
Good evening, Mr. Fields.
What did he say?
I said, good evening, that's all.
Let's not jump at conclusions.
Charlie, I've been telling Mr. Fields that you want to apologize. Now, isn't that right?
Yes, it is. Yes, I do, Mr. Fields. I do.
Well, that's just fine, my little chump. Chum, yeah. Yes, he goes again. That's fine. Tell me, my little man, why did you set a trap in my garden? Don't you know there aren't any skunks there?
No skunks in your garden, Mr.
No.
I'm sorry.
No wildlife, with one possible exception. My place is occasionally infested with a herd. Pink mastodons.
Oh, elephants, yeah.
That's right.
I hear that the elephants around your place take aspirin to get rid of W.C. Fields.
I love them, little nippers.
Yeah.
Is it true, Edgar, that Charlie can trace his ancestry back to an old chestnut stump, the abode of a family of pole cats?
Yeah. This is like the old days, isn't it, Bill?
Yeah, boy. Remember how we used to fight, Mr. Fields?
Yeah.
Foolish, wasn't it?
Yes, was, my little friend. But we're above that sort of thing now.
Yes, those are the good old days, aren't they, Bill?
Yeah, remember the time I said I'd slice you into a Venetian blind?
Yeah.
That was a good one. I think I don't know, was it?
Yeah, it was. Remember how I topped you by saying that makes me shudder?
Who said you topped me?
I topped you.
Well, the only laugh you ever got was a sneer from a disgruntled termite.
Why? You keep that up and you play a return engagement at the hospital.
Better be careful, my little friend. You know, wood pulp is in the priority list.
Yeah, well, listen, you long-nosed hang-eater. Now, wait a minute.
Gentlemen, please, gentlemen.
Bergen, I'm afraid Mr. Fields just doesn't love me anymore, that's all.
Don't tell me I don't love you, or I'll break every knot in your body.
Now, wait a minute.
That's the wrong attitude,
Bill. Why can't we be friends?
What do you say, Charlie?
Okay. I'll make one more attempt at appeasement.
Yes.
Then I'll fire on sight.
Yes. You'll do nothing of the kind, Charlie. You're going to be nice to Mr. Fields.
But he doesn't like me.
Why, idolize the little chap. I'd do anything for him.
Would you, Mr. Fields?
Why, I'd be glad to. Anything the little chap craves.
Hey, well, Mr. Fields, I have a new bicycle, you see.
Oh, would you like a bell?
Well,
I can, I'm not affluent, but I could buy you a bell.
Well, that's nice that I have a bell. But I was just wondering if I could borrow... Oh, I don't suppose it'd be right.
Yes, it's all right.
Oh, no.
I love the little...
No, it isn't right.
Oh.
Could I borrow your nose for a tail light?
Oh, you.
Well, Bill, it's only the mischief in the boy. That's all it is. That's what makes him say those things. Why, Charlie is his own worst enemy.
Not while I am around, he's not. Can he borrow my nose for a tail light? Why, I'll fill him full of your lead and use him for a pencil.
Yeah, I'll throw my lapel bag in here. Wait a minute. I want to hang one on him.
No, you don't. Now, stop it. Remember, Mr. Fields is not a well man, are you, Bill?
No, that's right, Edgar.
Yeah.
I've been a fragile thing of beauty ever since I was born.
Yeah.
Why, you weren't born. You were squeezed out of a bar rag. Now...
Shut him up, He's full of chipmunk, yeah.
Now, gentlemen, please, will you please stop?
Oh, my nose, a soiled tail. If you were sawdust on a barroom floor, I'd walk 10 blocks to a drugstore to get an ice cream soda. Yeah. Horseradish flavor.
Looks like a tail, I
got tonight. Well, tell me, Stan, does that one bring back some memories for you?
Yes, indeed. And I'll now drop the other boot on that story. We still have Reber with the Chase and Sanborn show unfilled. That is, no big star. When he heard the success that this ventriloquist had on the Valley show, he wanted to put that on the big Chase and Sanborn show. But Bergen was nobody. I mean, this was a nightclub act, and it was successful. It didn't have national prestige. He says, I will make national prestige in 13 weeks. So he hired W.C. Fields to have a fight with Charlie for 13 weeks. And you know, you have a fight with a fella, Nixon and Kennedy. You have a fight with a fella, he's going to be as big as you are, right?
That's right.
And that is a case in point right there. It was a marvelous programming move. And then at the end of 13 weeks, Charlie could carry on.
You know, it might be interesting, Ed, to explore with Stan how one of these comedy skits was put together.
Yeah, it's. I always wondered about that exactly. You know, do you sit up and you call yourself in a room and you know, turn on all the lights and think, or how do you really put a say you did have a guest like W.C. Fields? How did you set the pace of the sketch and so forth?
I got out to Chase and Sanborn a couple of months or so after Fields was gone. I never worked with W.C. Fields, but the way the spots were put together for the Bergen McCarthy. Spots were put together for Chase and Sanborn. There were two spots, the Bergen-McCarthy spot alone up front, and then Bergen with McCarthy and maybe Snerd, Mortimer Snerd, but Bergen and McCarthy and the dramatic guest. The dramatic guest was the big star guest. There were two guests on Kraft on Chase and Sanborn each week. One was the big star dramatic. The other was the second comedy, the Vera Vague, Billy Gilbert type supporting comic.
Well, didn't Don Ameche appear quite often in
he
a
was
role
the MC.
Like that? He was the MC.
He carried the show. Mm-hmm. He sang a couple of songs, and he carried the show. He and Dorothy L'Amour and Nelson Eddy. It was quite a lineup.
It was.
Tell you how these spots were built. Dick Mack was the writer for the J. Walter Thompson Company. Cal Kuhl was the producer. Both of those men were employed by J. Walter Thompson in the Hollywood office. Dick Mack would, together with Ed, decide on a Sunday night after the show, after they'd finished one show, what the spot ideas would be for the next week. There would be a spot for the Bergen-McCarthy spot up front. There would be a spot. Obviously, the idea would come from the character of the star that was going to be used. They'd invent an idea for the Bergen-McCarthy spot. Now, each would go to his own stable of gag writers. Bergen had a group of about four writers headed by a man with the very interesting name of Zeno Klinker. It's true.
Did he write a lot?
he got some very good material up for Ed, and Dick had a bunch of writers that he would get gags on these ideas. Now, he and a girl named Dina Carlson, who was a stenographer and a wonderful girl who knew the business, and Bergen would meet at Bergen's house, and they would talk the spot out together. Bergen had this tremendous talent for the character. He knew identically what was Charlie and what was not. And his comic talent and intuition and Dick's comic talent and structure knowledge joined to make a spot that Dina would be taking down in shorthand. She'd take it back to the office. It would be maybe 10, 12 minutes long. She'd type it out. Dick would blue pencil it and get it down to maybe 7 minutes. Both spots would be done on two different days, the same way, in the middle of the week. On Saturday, they'd get into rehearsal. They'd read it. There would be ad-libs that would come that they'd throw in. They'd now sit down for a real writing session Saturday night.
and get these two spots down to about 5.5-6 minutes. And then the next morning, after the orchestra had been rehearsed and the songs had been rehearsed and everything else was out of the way and cleared from the studio, we'd go in and rehearse the comedy. And then there'd be some more word changes, and that would be the spot that would go on the air, and it would go on the air that way. There wasn't much ad-libbing after you got on the air.
I'm going to interrupt here for a station break. I want to remind our listeners that they're tuned to WTIC in Hartford, Connecticut, as we present the first in the series, The Golden Era of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and with me is your co-host, Ed Corcoran, the man who supplies us with all of these wonderful memories on tape. And our special guest tonight is Stanley Quinn, director of the Radio and Television Center at the University of Connecticut. Our director, Brian Hartnett, asks the question, Stan, was Mae West ever a regular on the show?
No, she was a very important guest in one of the early Chasen Sanborn, Charlie McCarthy programs. And her spot was, well, it was received with a certain amount of shock.
Oh, really?
In the homes and offices of the land. And everything shuddered and then settled, and the show went on from there.
Well, now, somewhere along the line, you made the transition to the Kraft Music Hall starring Bing Crosby. And we're going to talk about that show at some length. But first, let's hear from the program itself, Ed.
Well, the Kraft Music Hall, like the Valley Show, was really one of the great shows of the year. There's no doubt about that. And the excerpt tonight is the opening, just to give people an idea how the show actually started, with the opening theme and then working into some of his regulars, including Bob Burns and Connie Boswell.
The Kraft Music Hall, starring Bing Crosby and Bob Burns, with Connie Boswell, John Scott Trotter and his orchestra, and the Music Maids. Bing's special guests for this evening are Lionel Barrymore and Eddie Bracken of the Cinema, and two of the world's outstanding percussionists, Thurston Knudsen and Augie Goupil. And here's Bing Crosby.
There are blues that you get from worry. There are blues that you get from pain. And there are blues when you're lonely, for you're one and only. Those blues you never can explain. There are blues that you get from longing, but the bluest blues that be are the sort of blues that's on my mind. They're the very meanest kind. Blues my naughty sweetie gives to me.
There are blues that you may get when you start to worry. There are wearing blues you get from pain. And there are blues when you're lonely, for you're one and only. The blues you never explain.
Oh, there are blues that you get from longing, but the blues that be are the sort of blues that's on my mind. They're the very meanest kind. Blues my naughty sweetie gives to
me. Nice going there, Bing. Nice going. How'd you like that, Robin?
I want to tell you, Connie, I was just saying to myself, I says, Robin, them five girls are getting the same prettier and prettier.
Well, I ain't going to argue with you about that, but how about Bing?
I have often wondered.
Well, I thought he really come on there the last 8 bars. Man, he went all out.
Say, Connie, I hate to be picky here, but ain't you getting kind of sick of everybody using that expression, all out? All I've been hearing lately is the world going all out for all out. I can remember when the expression all out was used only by conductors.
All
out? Yeah, now even my Aunt Pudgy, that's her name, that's my stout aunt. My Aunt Pudgy wrote me that she sent away to a mail order house in St. Louis and got herself a new two-way stretch all out girdle.
An all out girdle?
Yeah, but Aunt Pudgy says she couldn't get it all in.
You're just trying to change the subject there, Robin. I asked you how you liked Bing singing, and you won't even give me an answer. Now, what you got against that boy?
Well, now, what makes you think I got anything against Bing? What? I worship the ground that man walks on. At least I did worship the ground he walked on.
When was that?
Last time I showed him over my place in the valley.
And so, friends, we leave Brogswell and Squirms, a guy and a gal killing the people on the runway of the Waldorf Cellar, and dissolve back into the Old Craft Music Hall, where over and above the aforementioned characters, we're happy to have with us such notables as Eddie Bracken, star of RKO's picture Too Many Girls, Augie Goupil and Thurston Knudsen, percussionist extraordinaire, and Mr. Lionel Barrymore. Yesterday, Lionel Barrymore finished his work with Wally Beery on Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's new screen version of The Bad Man. And today, Lionel started on another tour of duty as Dr. Gillespie in the Kildare series. Always one of the busiest Barrymores in Hollywood, Lionel hasn't really let down on his work in years. It's a wonderful thing, Lionel. I mean the way you've been appearing in one picture right after another, year after year after year. I don't know how you stand it.
I don't know how the public stands it.
Don't worry, if they'll hold still for Bob Hope and me, they'll take anything.
Bing's right, Lionel. I mean about you working so much. With three of you Barrymores in the business, I don't see why you have to do all the work.
Well, Bob, my sister Ethel was always the talented one of the family. As for me, work's developed into a sort of bad habit. Now, John became the greatest Hamlet of his generation. Played in Shakespeare's hometown, too, which is a top spot for an actor. Now, after that, there wasn't much in particular left for him to do. So he's been doing that mighty well ever since.
Certainly can't deny that. You know, he goes on the radio right next door with Rudy Valley in just a few minutes.
It's a funny thing. Now, John's next door with Rudy Valley and me here with Bing Crosby. If we could only find a crooner for Ethel now.
Say, why don't you do something about that, Bing? Why don't you mention Ethel's name to Dick Todd?
Dick Todd and I are not speaking.
Say, you know, on second thought, Ethel might be able to work better with you, Burns.
Well, now, Lionel, I'm awful flattered to hear you say that.
Yeah, I think she'd be fine with you. You know, when you consider how successful she is right now in that play, The Corn is Green.
Certainly, she with Bob, she could make Arkansas saute.
Well, you know something, Bing?
Huh?
I'm surprised Lionel Barrymore even talks to you and Bob.
He is.
Well, I mean, a man like him who's really done something worthwhile in the theater.
Yeah.
Gosh, Lionel, must be wonderful to portray a character.
Well, portraying a character's all right. The trouble is when it comes to really being a character. Men like Burns overdo it.
You don't seem to get what I mean. Now, you take that Dr. Gillespie and kill that picture. When I see you do that part, Lionel, I really and truly believe you're a doctor. I don't think you're an actor.
Neither do I.
Well, now, wait a minute, Lionel. You're not going to disillusion all us movie fans about the way you feel that you're really being a doctor.
Now, Connie, if I were really a doctor, would I be here now?
Why not? We could use a doctor around here. You've kind of made Burns and Crosby look sick.
Well, now, if you really want a doctor, I'll give you one. The best kind of doctor the world has ever known. The modern specialists know a lot more, and they certainly charge a lot more, but no man will ever transcend in human understanding the plain, old-fashioned country doctor. I'm afraid there aren't many of them left.
That's a very nice tribute to a fine group of men, Lionel.
Yeah, that's a very fine tribute to a great show. Mary Jane Higby, in her book Tune In Tomorrow, relates the time when she was the announcer, believe it or not, for Kraft on the Bing Crosby Show, and she was amazed to discover that Bing, who sounded so relaxed, was reading everything word for word. She just could not comprehend this.
Well, I'm sure she comprehended it. Pretty good professional herself. But the interesting thing about that show, the Kraft Music Hall, when it started, before it started, Carol, who was going to write it and really be the guiding genius, the presiding genius for it, spent some time out at the Crosby home and heard this relaxed, marvelous guy who was not the straight singer who was appearing before him in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
So he sat down and wrote that character into the script. It was the real Bing, but it wasn't the show business Bing at that time. And, of course, it worked like gangbusters. And it's been Bing ever since. But sure, he read it all. But it was great stuff to read.
I enjoyed hearing the voice of Bob Burns again.
Yes, you worked with Bob Burns. Maybe a lot of the people don't remember him. I guess his most famous contribution to civilization was the fact he invented the bazooka, which is still being used, I guess, by the armed forces today. A slightly different version.
Slightly different version, yes.
But, what was it like to work with him? Did he work with you or contribute his own ideas?
Ed, you said that I had moved on to the Kraft Music Hall. I was never a regular on the Kraft Music Hall. It was out of our shop in Hollywood, out of the J. Walter Thompson radio office. But occasionally, when somebody would be sick, if Carol, for instance, was laid up, I might be pulled in. And on one occasion, I did write a spot for Burns. I remember at the time, he was a little skeptical about this young... washed Ivy type kid who was out there writing formats or something, writing a spot for him. We were both of us vastly pleased when the spot worked.
Very good. Did he play the bazooka in your spot too?
No, no, the spot didn't use the bazooka.
You know, we're going to go back in time now. I have really no recollection of this show, Ed, and I have a hunch it goes back to the early or mid-30s. This is one that Stan was not associated with, but certainly it's typical of the era, starring a great singer for his day, Harry Richmond.
I didn't know much about Harry, but I understand he was really one of the real show business greats. I think probably by the time, say, World War II came around, he had already more or less declined or was not as active as he once was. But in this particular show, he features a duo here known as Tim and Irene. And the reason I brought it along, because it is of the era we're speaking of, or a little before it, but Irene, in the sketch, is still a very well-known personality on television, and I wonder if after people hear it, whether they might recognize who it is.
You mean you're not going to tell us now?
No, why don't we wait till after the excerpt is played and see whether anybody can figure who Irene is here.
All right, the Tim and Irene Show.
To me.
Promise? Who, me?
Certainly you did. I'm going to be your secretary at your filling station.
Oh, yeah, I was afraid of that. And what do you know about being a secretary? You ever keep books?
Well, if I like them, I do. And if I don't, I return them to the library.
Oh, no, I mean books for my office. You know, like double entry.
Double entry? Oh, don't be silly. I make triple entry.
Now, how can you make triple entry?
Well, one set is for the boss, showing the real profit.
One set showing the real profit.
And the second set is for the shareholders, showing no profit.
I see. And what about the third set?
The third set is for the income tax people, showing a loss.
You're hired. Can you take care of the outside, you know, like giving gas, air, greasing a car?
Oh, I don't like greasing cars. I'd rather sell oil.
You'd rather sell oil?
Yes, more refined. Hey, where are you going?
Well, my ears need resting. I'm going to ask Harry to sing.
Always ready to oblige a pal. I'll sing I Feel So Spanish Tonight. Just give me a sweet senorita with a rose in her hair like Marquita, 'cause I feel so Spanish tonight. Give me lots of tambourine and a steel guitar, any old guitar, and you'll hear me sing the cucaracha, yummy caracopa. Now I'm known as a gay caballero whenever I wave my sombrero, but some girl it means sweet delight. My feelings for love, I can't trust it. I call
All right, Stan, do you have any idea who Irene might be?
Well, no, I didn't recognize Irene.
Now, come on, you fellas are putting me on here. You mean I get to be an expert here? Well, that was Irene Ryan, who is in the Beverly Hillbillies, playing the role of the grandma.
Well, I'll
how about
tell
that?
You.
You know, now, if you were to give the information to the audience first and let them listen to it, you'd recognize all of the characteristics in the voice.
Exactly. Well, not all.
We'll do it the next show.
Then I think that for people listening today who, unfortunately, and I feel that way about radio, did not grow up in the era, the golden era of radio, it may be hard for them to realize as they watch television, all of the shows, either on film or on videotape, that these programs that we're listening to tonight were done live.
Yes, done live, like we're live
now. That's right.
But we, being live now, are an occasion.
Mm-hmm.
We're not the normal pattern. In the 30s, big time, prime time, night time, big entertainment radio was all live. There were no recorded spots. There was nothing on the networks that was not happening as you were listening to it. It gave a kind of intimacy, a kind of participatory feeling for the listener who had this friend coming to him through his radio or her radio. This friend was living, breathing, might fall dead right now. I perhaps could make it clear the difference by saying to people, is there a difference between seeing the astronauts live, putting that first foot down on the moon, or seeing it that night on tape?
Mm-hmm.
It was that richness which radio in the 30s had, which was a great, great blessing.
It certainly was. I'm sure that people are perhaps puzzled by the fact that we do then have recordings, Ed. You might explain that.
Well, there were several reasons. And again, maybe I'm treading on dangerous ground when I mention advertising agencies, but one of the reasons I suspect was that they had to have copies of shows to prove to the client that they got their certain time. And occasionally it was done because of time differences, although most of the time they rebroadcast the entire show, but
right.
There were occasions when they did record them and then play back for another time zone.
Or perhaps a local station would record the show.
The recordings were mostly in the early days for file purposes and legal purposes.
Legal.
And disc. They didn't play. They did live repeats.
Yes.
The pattern in prime time was live repeats.
Which meant that if you did a program at 9 o'clock for the East Coast and Central Time Zone, you then went into a studio at midnight.
Right.
And
right.
did another show
right.
for the West Coast.
Right.
And the same show.
Really. This is why a lot of production went to Hollywood. Not only because of the stars, but because there you could do your show out there at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and you just did one show. This is the way the Jack Benny show at five on the coast, and we were five on the coast, so he was four on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they took him. Of course, that's Sunday. You couldn't do that on the weekdays.
No, I suppose not. Well, one of the great shows, we mentioned this earlier, Eddie Cantor was the originator, I guess, of the Chase and Sanborn Hour. He was the star originally back in the 30s, wasn't he? One of many.
One of several, yes.
And he, in turn, gave us a lot of characters. Ed, what are we going to hear from the Eddie Cantor show tonight?
Well, we have some very short excerpts, but these are some of the guests that appeared. The first one would be Burns and Allen, and the rest will be regular members of the cast that he had. But the Burns and Allen, I think everybody remembers that, of course, from the TV days that were just very recent past.
Why, it's Gracie Allen!
Oh, for goodness sake!
Oh, Gracie, what are you doing here? I didn't expect you.
Well, neither did my mother, but here I am.
Gracie, I like you, but I'm having trouble enough.
Yeah, I know. I heard your program last week. Well, why are you going to let that awful
Mrs. Brown to produce a picture for you is a mystery to me. Now, if you let me produce a picture, it'll be a mystery to everybody.
I know that, but Gracie...
Boy, you don't have to worry if I produce the picture. I've never ruined anybody's career, and all I want is a chance.
Yeah, look, Gracie, when it comes to making pictures, you're a complete novice.
Oh, please, I'm not that good.
You're Eddie, having trouble?
George Burns, yes.
How long has Gracie been here?
Oh, about 3 or 4 minutes, George.
Have an aspirin.
Say, Eddie.
Yeah?
Who's this?
Who's this?
Yeah. He follows me home every night.
Gracie, what are you talking about? That's George Burns. You've been together for 15 years.
Oh, no wonder you get so fresh, huh?
Give me back the aspirin.
No, you better take your headache home with you.
Okay, good night, Eddie.
Good night, and I'll heckle you on your show next Monday.
Well, come on, Gracie, come on.
Oh, wait, I haven't finished the story
come
yet.
On,
so the ink is now dying. Well,
incidentally, Dick, and Stan already knows, everything on air you heard was live. There was no recorded laugh tracks or no recorded applause. It was just what the audience, how they reacted to the show. The next one is a very famous personality called Park Your Carcass, who later had his own show, both on radio and television.
Park Your Carcass, you a plastic surgeon? You're a fake, a fraud, a phony.
That's a lie, and I wish I could prove it.
All right, Parky, now let's get down to business.
Yeah?
Whatever gave you the idea of becoming a plastic surgeon?
Racetracks. You see, always when the races is over, everybody's coming out with long faces.
Well?
I listen.
Wait a minute. Me? You're going to improve my face? You?
Too big a job for one man, huh?
Get away.
Well, you know, that kind of typifies the comedian with a kind of a special voice. When you wrote for this kind of a comedian, the guy that had a funny voice, did you write differently than for a man who was strictly a comic, like, say, Bob Hope would be?
Well, you had to write for the character, and this would be part of the character, but I want to tell you, I had a problem once. I was new out in Hollywood, and Hollywood to me at that time was heaven. I mean, really, I thought I was one of the real tuts that I should be allowed to be out there. And I'm sitting there, and I have to write a spot with Sterling Holloway, and he comes in to discuss the spot with me. But he talks just like Sterling Holloway. And I'm sitting there, and I had the worst time. It finally worked out all right, but
you wanted to laugh.
That was his real self, huh?
All right, back to Eddie Cantor.
Well, the other very famous personality was the Mad Russian. We're not mad at him anymore, I hope. But this, I think he was really the only Russian dialect comedian that was ever popular on radio. And let's listen to him now, shall we?
Gosh, what I need is help. Ooh. A high-powered publicity man. A fellow who will get my name before the American people. A man who is a master of words. A man who created a famous slogan such as, "How do you do?" Why is the great Gordon the Mad Russian? Russian, you are a publicity man?
Most of course. I will go up to the head of the Associated Press, and I will say to him, "Reginald." But he won't answer me.
Why not?
His name is Maya.
Why, you don't even know anybody in the newspaper business.
Would you like to see how I get the story in the paper?
Yes, go ahead.
I'll call up the newspaper.
Go ahead.
Hello? Give me the desk. The city desk. Hello, desk. Look in your top drawer and see if I left my lunch there. Listen, Dad. Eddie Cantor is running for president. Give me a rewrite.
Hello, rewrite.
I just got a hot flush. Composing room.
Hello, room. Oh, I'm sorry, I got the wrong room.
Hello, composing room. Eddie Cantor is running for president. Now the press is off the road.
Yes.
Out comes an extra. I run down to the corner, pick up a paper, and the mile I made.
Am I amazed?
Why? Eddie Cantwell, you're running for president?
You know, Stan, whenever we talk about this golden era, you always work in the word taste, good taste. And it really did represent good taste, didn't it?
Yes. It went back to the fact that the shows were proprietary shows in the sense of each one represented a given manufacturer and advertiser who wanted his show to have the proper image of his company in the homes. He insisted that his radio show be a guest in the home. As a result, you have not heard too much of the element of sentimentality. There was a tremendous amount of schmaltz in radio.
Mm-hmm.
Sentimentality that you listen to and it makes you cringe, but it is none of it done in a sense of wanton relaxation of taste. It's all respecting the home listener, who is a friend. Truly, it was friendship on tap. And the kind of intimacy, the kind of participation represented by such things as a King of England coming out and telling the world on radio the closest secrets of his heart, an impossible thing to do with pictures of him.
Mm-hmm.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the greatest performer on radio in the 30s, taking this country from a depression attitude through to a preparation when it really wasn't ready to prepare for a major conflict. This man, with his fireside chat, imagine how he understood radio to call it a fireside chat.
Yeah.
He was in your living room. He was with you, and he truly was. You just believed it. You listen to those recordings today. You believe it.
Well, I think that summarizes the era very nicely. Ed, what are we going to hear on some future shows?
Well, just to name a few, Dick, we're going to do Send in a Box Top, which is a survey of all the kid shows. Jock, Jack, Doc, and Reggie, which everybody knows is I Love a Mystery. A Story on the Comedians, some horror shows, Whodunit, the look at all of the detectives.
The Thundering Hoof Beats.
Oh, yeah, that's another one, Fred Allen. And maybe we'll do a special on Humphrey Bogart. I've always wanted to do that
wonderful.
On radio.
We're going to be back in about a month. We're going to have a show once a month, and we'll let you know here on WTIC exactly when. Our thanks to our special guest tonight, Stanley Quinn, director of the Radio and Television Center at the University of Connecticut, for sharing his delightful stories and experiences with us. This is Dick Bertel.
And Ed Corcoran.
And we'll see you next time on the Golden Era of Radio.
Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad. The transcribed story of the violence that moved west with young America. And the story of a man who moved with it. I'm that man, Matt Dillon.
Dr. Christian's office.
Yes, there's the clock in Glen Falls Town Hall, telling us it's time for Rinso's story of Big Sister, brought to you by the new...
Our director was Brian Hartnett. The engineer was Dick Swerko. You're tuned to 1080 Radio. This is WTIC in Hartford.